Welcome to Nocturnal Admissions, the Las Vegas Weekly Nightlife Podcast. I'm Deanna Rilling, and this week I am fortunate enough to have electronic music producer and composer BT as my guest. Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Thank you so much for taking the time out to talk with us.
Pleasure. Yeah. Absolutely.
So I guess first off, you'll be at Rain Nightclub at the Palms here in Vegas on February 20th. With these hopeful machines, you were going with kind of a whole album experience. So how much of the album will you perform at the gig here in Vegas? Will you try to recreate the experience live or stick to fan favorites or something else?
It's a great question, and it is my first gig because I've gotten snowed out twice in D.C. Since the album has come out. The album came out last Tuesday. So it's a laptop symphony show, so it's me performing with a laptop and a bunch of proprietary software and actually a bunch of new USB controllers and some new computers and stuff. I'm really excited about it, and it is the first time that I'm going to get to play a lot of material from the new album, but it's not like a live band show, and we will be doing those actually coming up in late spring or early summer, but it's going to be an incredible show, and like I said, it's the first time where I can actually freely perform any of the music or remixes from the album, which is really exciting for me because, you know, you want to an extent sort of shelter your audience from some of the things just because then the way that people are exposed to them is from crappy YouTube clips.
Right.
So, you know what I mean? So it's the first time where now people have heard the music, and so I can go out and, like, confidently play remixes of all the different things. And all together, with remixes, the album is 6.8 hours long. So It's crazy. There's an extraordinary amount of ancillary material that people haven't heard. I'm really excited to play some of these mixes for people.
Cool. Now, for you, you did mention the laptop symphonies, and that's how your shows are often billed, at least when you come to Vegas. So many know for producers like, let's see, Paul Van Dyke, for example. He's up there creating live loops. He's got multiple keyboards, mixers, and the like. So what does yours entail when you're in the booth? What programs are you running, et cetera, for some of the tech geeks out there?
I love these sort of questions. And just kind of funnily, a lot of guys, and Paul I consider to be a friend, but, you know, Sasha and Lee from Deep Dish and all these guys made fun of me for years and years and years and years. Dude, that's not performing. You can't be up there with a laptop. And I do tech support for all these guys now, quite literally. They call me like, oh, my USB port's broken. Oh, I can't get these extensions working. You know, Tiesto, all of them. It's really funny and actually completely true. Get random phone calls every weekend from these guys. But similar to, what I guess is becoming, to an extent less fringe. I'm performing using a combination of computers, synths, USB controllers, and some commercially available software, some proprietary software, all live. And so I use Ableton Live.
Okay.
And I'm using Ableton with, and another cool thing about Live is, and again with this group of guys, it's just sort of funny, is I've been told, actually by the guys at Ableton, that I was the first person to ever use the software to perform with. Which is cool because I had an early alpha version of Live, and it's neat to see it have become such a big thing. You know, I remember when the guys from M Audio were distributing Ableton, and they gave me an alpha build of it, and I took it out immediately and performed with it, and people were like, what are you doing with a laptop on stage? That's, like, not allowed.
Right.
I use Ableton, and I use it with a bunch of plugins that myself and my team of guys at Sonic Architects have coded. I have a software company. Then we released our first commercial application. Last year we released the first remix engine for the iPhone called Sonify. And we're working on a new build of that too. And so I've built a tool called Stutter Edit that I use for live buffer cutting and glitching effects, and the things optimized to perform with. And it does these incredibly complicated sort of meta gestures where, you know, up to close to 150 parameters are being modulated, across modulated and modulated in real time. I'm using that plugin, I'm using a live looping tool that we've created too, that's kind of more like a dev tool. I don't think we'll ever release that. And then, you know, lots of, you know, off-the-shelf store-bought plugins and stuff, and doing live composition and mashups and bits and pieces of some of my tracks, some of other people's tracks, live synthesis, tons of live effect work. It's just, it's an amazing thing. You know, it's funny because now in the studio, you know, after a month of work on a single composition, and you get to that moment where you've done thousands of passes of automation data and, you know, spent, you know, weeks pouring your heart and soul into, you know, zeros and ones, we get to the final moment and you press the space bar and you render the track and it's finished, you know, and it's after playing loads of live instruments, some even having live orchestra, you know, like drums and guitars, bass, all these sort of things, singing, comping, and all these kind of things. It's so funny now, using a program like Ableton Live and then, you know, these plugins that we've developed at my company, I'm actually performing electronic music more live than I do in the studio. It's really exciting. So taking all these bits and pieces from my records, things that I'm composing live, bits and pieces from other people's records, and recontextualizing all of these chunks and making something new in front of everyone. And it's so exciting. It's like literally like, it's almost like the feeling of playing with a live band, but you're there on your own. Mm-hmm. So it's really exciting. Something I love doing.
Do you record those at all? I mean, since you are creating something brand new, do you like make a backup copy just in case you do something completely crazy you want to try to remember and recreate again?
I wish I did. It's such a great question, too. You know, I've had so many times people come up to me after and say, oh my God, what was that remix of whatever? Fill in the book. Like, there was a mashup that I did for a while that's funny, then someone, I can't remember who it is, did an official remix of it, of Smells Like Teen Spirit. I was mashing it up with bits and pieces from a Meet Katie track and a Dylan Rhymes thing, and a loop from Timo Moss, like a ton of different stuff. Anyway, and then some guitar parts from Are You Gonna Go My Way? Played it. Every time I played it, it was different, but I probably did it 3 or 4 times. I remember playing it in Seattle on New Year's, and you know, like 15,000 people lost their minds. And after that, I was signing some autographs, and people were like, oh my God, where can I buy that mix? And I was like, you can't. And I do record it, so I hope there's a crappy YouTube clip of that, because I didn't record. I should, honestly, you know, the throughput, the processing power of these computers makes it a little bit daunting and frightening to try to record the density of controller data that I'm generating in real time. So it's something I'm looking at in the future about possibly just bringing some kind of digital audio recorder and hooking it into the board and recording it that way, as opposed to trying to record what I'm actually doing. But they've been recorded, some of them, but not enough, very sporadically.
Mm-hmm. Maybe get like a group of people, kind of like a bunch of deadheads, to do bootleg copies from the club or something like that.
That would be amazing. You know, that would be amazing. You know, some of those definitely exist for the various live tours that I've done. When I toured This Binary Universe with Thomas Dolby, and when I toured Movement and Still Life, there are some amazing recordings of some of those shows. I recently heard one of me playing Movement and Still Life and parts of ESCM and HEMA in, I guess, 2001 at the Warfield Theater on Halloween. And it's incredible. I couldn't believe the fidelity of the recording. So I know that there are a lot of recordings that have been passed to me of me performing live with a band, but I think less of me doing laptop sets. It's something sort of in 2010 that I'm thinking much more about, for sure.
Cool. And then for the gig at Rain, do you think you might sing live at all, since you do sing on many of your tracks?
It's possible. You know, one of the things that I love doing, depends on the night, but many, many times I've plugged headphones into the mic input of the DJM 800
right.
and just sung live right into the mixer. And the first time somebody saw me do it, they were like, what the hell are you doing? They're headphones. You can't sing into them. And I'm like, listen, it sounds great. It's kind of bandpass filtered. They're like, oh my God, dude, you're nuts. But yeah, it's possible for sure. You know, anything's possible. That's the thing I love about live performance is when it's good, you're always kind of riding that thin edge between it all kind of disintegrating into nothingness and, you know, pure, you know, sort of enlightenment or something. Mm-hmm. It's like, so I'm really looking forward to it. I love performing in Vegas. It's one of my favorite places to play. The crowds are really, really good there, and people are there to have a good time and to have an experience. And so, you know, that's what I'm there to provide.
Mm-hmm. So kind of switching gears and talking specifically about the new album, which, as you mentioned, came out last Tuesday, February 2nd. These Hopeful Machines is probably the first time in a while where I've gone, wow, this is a really incredible album, and recommended it to people. You've got like multi-part harmonies, it flows from one track to another, there's diversity in genres touched upon. So what for you, what do you want the listeners to feel with this album, and is there any particular message that you're hoping to convey?
That is a fantastic question, and one that I haven't been asked yet, honestly, mm-hmm. in like stacks of interviews. And yeah, there is a message to it. And obviously, you know, when someone makes something, you know, someone carves a table or they paint a painting or they write a song or they make an album, whatever it is, it has meaning and significance personal for them. And you know, I'm deeply emotionally invested in all of these compositions, you know, in a variety of ways, and some of them in ways that I would never want to talk about, just because I wouldn't want to take away the experience from someone else who's going to attach something completely different to it. That's the beautiful thing about music, is people, it resonates with different people so differently. You know, people have come up to me, I remember the first time someone said this to me, this has happened more than once now, but I'll never forget the first time someone said this to me. A girl came up to me in Australia. I was walking across a bridge in Sydney. I wasn't performing or anything. She stopped me on the street and she said, I gave birth to your music. And I was like, oh my God. And it was like, literally, it stopped, like literally actually physically took my breath away. It was so unexpected. It wasn't like, hey, how's it going? And she stopped me and she said, I gave birth to your music.
That's
and
incredible.
That was how the conversation started. And so she started talking about what it was and what she was listening to. That same piece of music, I've heard so many people talk about having different experiences of sitting in the jungle. There's like, it's strange because there's certain songs that I've had, you know, 100, 200 different fans come up and tell me such different stories about what they experienced while listening to it. And this, you know, this song they dedicated to someone that they lost, you know, it was played at their funeral, you know, it all about this same song. And this other kid that was like doing some sort of like missionary work, listened to this song in the jungle, just incredible things all around this one song. So, sorry, it's a very loquacious story to explain.
It's okay.
When you're doing this for as long as I've been doing it, it's like you start amassing different perspectives about different things. And so for me personally, what I'd like for people to take away from these Hopeful Machines is, and it's in the title, the through line, like the emotional through line, this whole body of work is this really poignant feeling of hope. And the thing that's really humbling to me is to hear my fans talk about it, and people that I don't even know, you know, that might not have ever, you know, expressed an interest in my work before this, talking about this and all walking away from it with the same sort of feeling that there's, you know, there's rises and falls and it undulates and it goes places, but that people walk away from it with this feeling of possibility and hope. And that really is sort of the lullaby I was writing to myself, if that makes sense.
Okay.
And so to see other people experience it in the same way is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
Now, for you, a lot of times people do bring up the fact that there's math that lies behind some of what you do musically. But for me, unlike math rock, which is kind of sometimes jarring and difficult to listen to, your music is engaging. So how do you keep the average listener involved and still being able to create like an emotional flow to it without overkilling it with technical prowess?
You're asking me such thoughtful questions. Can you do the rest of my interview with me today? I'm serious. These are really thoughtful questions. No bullshit. Seriously, I'm really enjoying this. Well, you know what? That's an amazing question. And I think for me, it's like mathematics can be something that's seen as like really sort of, you know, impenetrable and obtuse. And this, it's almost like, you know, a secret society, right? Like it's a way that mm-hmm. people can talk and communicate that seems very sort of elitist and exclusionary. Like it keeps people out. And that's not how I have like an emotional rapport with, it's interesting that people bring up math with my work because obviously I do have a great affinity for it.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that I regard math is, and my affinity for it is from my sort of awe of the natural world, you know? So I look at, for example, I read this amazing piece about Jackson Pollock.
Mm-hmm.
And in this piece, it was in an Art Digest magazine, they said that some mathematicians had analyzed his work and they had, you know, so they had basically like a bunch of amateurs try to imitate Jackson Pollock's paintings.
Right.
And then they put them up and people could totally perceive a difference. And you know his work, it's just
Yeah, it's just splatters. Right?
Yeah. And so, but people could somehow really feel a difference between the fake Jackson Pollock's and then Jackson Pollock's work. So what they did was they took a bunch of mathematicians and they analyzed the way the paint the symmetry and the way the paint was splattered on the canvas mm-hmm. in Pollock's paintings to just sort of a random kind of splattering. And what they noted was that Jackson Pollock's paintings all expressed similar sets of fractals.
Hmm.
And they have this beautiful mathematical symmetry to them. Now, he wasn't thinking about math when he was, you know, there splattering paint on a canvas, but that translated in this incredibly evocative and emotional way. And that's what I mean when I say that I have this love for mathematics. It's like, you know, when I'm outside, you know, sitting on the ground and looking at trees and throwing rocks in a pond, something I regularly do actually, and looking at the beautiful way that a rock displaces the water,
mm-hmm.
it makes these beautiful displacement maps, and then it bounces off the sides, and it creates these gorgeous interference patterns. I think, wow, that's music right there. That right there is music. And that is what inspires me about mathematics, is the way that it's expressed in the natural world. You know, mathematics is the language that nature speaks with. That's what I think is so beautiful about it, is there's these reoccurring themes in the natural world that spring up all around us, and those are the things that inspire me and that inform my work.
Mm-hmm. If you have a few more minutes, I just had some questions about like some of the specific tracks. Like you've got Jess, which she's always amazing. She's on Every Other Way and The Light and Things. But on Every Other Way, you even got Stuart Copeland from The Police on the drum breakdown. So how did that partnership come about? Because it's pretty badass at the end of the track.
Thank you. Stuart's amazing. We have this thing that's called the Round Table Composers Dinner. And at that dinner, it's, you know, a bunch of different film composers, which, in addition to being the drummer of The Police,
mm-hmm.
Amongst other things, you know, drum god, Stuart is an amazing right. film composer. And so Stuart attends that dinner, and there's about 12 of us. It's something we've been doing for a couple of years now, and he's like the crabby uncle of the group. He's got like the English sense of, you know, cynicism and wit. He's hysterical, and we got to be friendly at that dinner, and you know, I said, hey, you know, I'd love for you to come in and, you know, play some stuff on Tony's tracks, and he did it, and it's just, you know, it's incredible, again, going kind of back to that Pollock metaphor, to watch, you know, the drums are such a sort of primordial instrument, and and to watch how differently different people's personalities transcend into that instrument is pretty spectacular. Stewart just has such a signature. It's like you can, you know, anywhere he plays, you can hear it in a couple of hi-hat ticks. It's pretty impressive. Mm-hmm.
And you were also involved in the art direction of the 2CD album. Can you tell me a little bit more about the artist that did the incredible artwork that's inside of it?
I have to say it again. I'm sorry. This is an awesome interview.
Thanks.
Like, nobody else is going to say you were involved in the art direction of this. I can't wait to... anyway, so
thanks.
That's true. Yeah, and there's an amazing modern artist by the name of Aaron Jasinski, who I found through DeviantArt, and I just absolutely fell in love with his work. Mm-hmm. And I asked him if he would paint a mural for these Hopeful Machines, and he agreed, and I was just beside myself. And we had this amazing experience of having... you know, 5 or 6 late night phone calls and just talking for hours about my life. And I sent him photographs and pictures of things that had significance and importance to me. And I talked to him about everything from kind of my, you know, personal belief system to my life experiences and everything in between, the things that I love and that inspire me. And out of these actually incredibly therapeutic conversations, started to spring sketches. And then over a period of 10 months, you know, Aaron painted this amazing 8-foot by 3-foot oil painting. There's no computers whatsoever. That's a man's hands with a paintbrush on a canvas. And I just think it's such a beautiful work of art, what he painted, and so reflective both of this body of work and of kind of what I stand for. He just super nailed it. And so anyways, just a joy to do that. And then Gavin Taylor, who's my longtime cohort in my album artwork, did this amazing layout of graphical typography ideas. You know, then we came up with the idea to do, you know, dual both-sided black CDs, and it's my favorite record of mine to hold. Like, it feels such like an object, and I really encourage people that that like the album, that have heard it, to get a physical copy of it. Mm-hmm. 'Cause it's the first time myself I've ever really felt in my own career where it's like actually complete. It feels like a complete thing. It's like the idea that I set out to make, you know,
right,
to put it in my hand, which is you know, not happened to me before, so it's super exciting.
I know a few of your fans have been asking if there is any way to get like a reproduction of the artwork, like a bigger one. Is that something that you might explore in the future?
Definitely. You know, I mean, we're going to do things like posters at the shows, and I'd like to do some posters the size of the painting. I would really like to find a way to do something where it's on stretched canvas too.
Okay.
Because there's ways that they can do that now where it's not just photo screening, but they actually do photo screening with slight, like, paint touches on top of photo screening. So
right.
I'm looking at some ways to do that creatively, and hopefully that's something that we can take around with us when we go out and do a live tour, because I want one.
I know, I do too.
I gotta find a way to make that happen. So.
And one thing you mentioned, real quick, you mentioned the typography. So I don't know if this is just me, but I noticed, like, on the album, you have the letter E backwards everywhere, except for on the title of Love Can Kill You. Was that an intentional thing of having that one being the only one that was the right direction? Or is that...
Do you want a job?
Is that just me? Well, no, I know a lot of times people put a lot of thought into these little things, so I noticed that, and I was wondering if it was intentional.
Yes, it was.
Great.
And the E, but I'm not going to tell you what that means.
Okay.
But it was intentional. But the E, again, kind of my affinity for math is a reference of, you know, backwards E in mathematics, meaning, you know, there exists. So, and I loved that idea. So we were trying to think of a way to have some, you know, typographical metaphor for math without being over the top. You're using some, like, esoteric symbol or whatever. So So that's what Gavin came up with, and I thought, cool. Wow, it's just beautiful. Yeah, I love it.
Cool. And then just real quick to wrap it up, let's talk Twitter. I'm pretty sure you tweet in your sleep. So
yeah, it's true. It's true.
Have you noticed that keeping in touch with your fans so well, especially through the course of this album's release, has differed or helped at all from previous albums?
Most definitely, to answer your question simply, and then kind of in more detail, it's shocking. I have a lot of artists coming to me right now saying, where are you thinking of all these sort of like, you know, fantastical kind of marketing, you know, initiatives? And I'm like, it's me and an iPhone. Like, there's no kind of like, you know, there's not some like, you know, 15 people in a room.
Right.
Like, doing, you know, demographic studies and, like, you know, analytics and stuff, I'm noticing an incredible shift in the way that I interact with my fans. It's it's completely real-time interactive. The things that they come up with, too, are incredible. And more than anything, the most exciting thing about interacting with fans in real time is I have really smart fans, and they say really, really clever, thoughtful, insightful things, and that just makes me feel less alone on a ball of dirt spinning in infinite space. So just right. For that alone, it's awesome.
Mm-hmm. And then just kind of like last one or two, for you, does the decline in physical album sales and an increase in illegal file sharing, is that part of the motivation for you to connect with your fans? Because it seems like even if people might just want to steal an album, if they have more of a connection with the artist, it seems to propel it a little bit. Just for example, I had spoken with Moby a little while back, and he said that he could only speak for himself, but he only makes music for two reasons, one of which being because he loves it and hopes people will be willing to listen to it. And for him, he figured that there's so much music out there personally, he's flattered if anyone takes the time to listen to it, so he doesn't mind if people kind of steal the music. So what's kind of your thought on file sharing, and does connecting help people buy it anyway?
Well, here's what I think about it. First of all, I think Moby would actually, and I know Moby for 20 years, and I think he would actually say something different personally were it to be off the record. I mean that, too. And I don't mean that as like a slight, hearing that answer and then having conversations that I've had with him, you know, on many a long and lonely night on a tour bus, I know that actually that's probably 80% the truth, but honestly, that mattered not at all to Moby after he made Play.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the difference, is because Moby sold 12 million copies of an album, he actually can say that and mean it, you know, that because once you've crossed a certain threshold, that one album for Moby will generate enough income for him for the rest of his life to do anything he wants musically, to create anything he wants. And that's an awesome thing, both for Moby and for electronic music.
Right.
When many of us look at that, that's like, that was the pinnacle of, like, that was the moment, like the zenith of when electronic music, you know, could move so many physical copies of an album, and so it's awesome that happened at all to anyone, and even more awesome that it happened to Moby, because he's a good guy. But that being said, if you have that kind of critical success, which is at this point not possible, that can fund any kind of, like, you know, sort of academic, creative endeavors you may ever want to have for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
For those of us, you know, of kind of the sort of working class, as it were,
right,
of artists, which means basically everyone besides Moby. I'm serious, too. You know, we rely on the support of our audience to make it possible for us to continue doing what we do, directly rely on them. So I have mixed feelings about it, but I'll tell you how I do feel about it is I think that, I have so many people that are fans for 10 years who found out about me because they downloaded something on LimeWire or, you know, from some torrent site and thought, this is awesome, and then went and investigated it and investigated more of it, and then went out and bought some albums and came to shows, and then I've come to tons of shows. And so at the end of the day, you know, that's someone that's made it possible for me to continue doing, you know, what I love. And so I'm deeply grateful for that. So so I think that, you know, I think it's a way to discover music. It's different. But from speaking from a personal vantage point, my own personal thoughts on this is the last thought is anything that I think provides meaning and value in my own life, I pay for. Uh-huh. And even if it's a small amount, even if it's someone being kind to me when I'm at Starbucks, you know, and putting money in the tip jar, like, when someone brings something additive to my life, mm-hmm. I feel good about rewarding that. It feels like the right thing to do. You know, sorry, it's a final thought on this. I've never, ever in my entire life ever made a record where I've seen my fans buying 10 and 20 copies of it.
Yeah.
There are literally thousands of tweets about stuff like this. Ooh, this thing happened over the weekend. People saying, all these people started saying, if you can't afford this record, ping me and I'm going to buy it for you. And I started linking all these people that couldn't afford the record. And just that feels awesome, mm-hmm. to feel like I've made something that, you know, is uplifting in a way that is additive. Mm-hmm. So that's the goal. So
kind of as a last hypothetical question, your album is called These Hopeful Machines, and a few years back, Fiona Apple came out with an album called Extraordinary Machine. So if you put a hopeful machine in a battle with an extraordinary machine, who do you think might win and why?
Well, I think we'd take her, for sure. If you see Fiona Apple, she's little. Just on size alone, we'd dominate. If it was the UFC... a hopeful machine would definitely take an extraordinary machine.
Fantastic.
No problem.
Fantastic. And then and then, since you spent quite a few years on this album, do you plan on taking a break from the studio, or do you already have your next artist album underway?
You know, I'm actually dying to get back into the studio. It's funny you should mention that. And you know, we're going to have a big tour this summer. Mm-hmm. Which is going to be awesome. And my hope is, you know, now that things are kind of smaller and more portable, is to have, you know, a halfway decent kind of portable setup with me so I can be working on the album over the summer, my next album over the summer. But I'm itching to get back in there. There's a lot of experiments on these hopeful machines that kind of came to fruition. Always is a great example of that. So is Les Nocturnes des Lumières, where, you know, always being this idea of, like, cut and paste almost music concrete to these kind of very sort of jangly indie guitar sort of thing. And that's an idea I really want to explore more. There's so many things that I've just begun to touch on in this album, but they congealed and worked. Mm-hmm. So I'm dying to get back in and
Cool. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it, and I'm definitely looking forward to checking you out on February 20th at Rain. And congratulations with the album and all the success it's had in such a short period of time so far.
Thank you for such a thoughtful interview. I really enjoyed this.
Why, thank you. All right, well, take care, and thanks again.
Okay, see you later.
Bye.
All right, bye-bye.
For up-to-date Las Vegas nightlife and dance music scene news, always be sure to check out LasVegasWeekly.com.